From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sidorick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Any measure that funds the government must include border security. Has to.
Our week in review on a looming government shutdown. Plus, Jimmy Tingle tells us why a comedian would run for office.
This is the message of the Democratic Party. Feed the hungry. House the homeless. Heal the sick. Welcome the stranger. And I would add, fix the teeth.
Also today, Boston Ballet's Kirsten Fintroy on diversity in ballet.
I think that it needs to come to a point where it's normal for us to have more dancers of color. So it's not, you know, 10 years without having a female African-American dancer in a company.
And?
Can I refill your eggnog for you? Get you something to eat? Drive you out to the middle of nowhere? Leave you for dead?
Cocktail ideas to help you make it through the holidays. It's all next on Radio Boston.
Chug-a-lug, chug-a-lug. Make you want how to hide.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. And it's been another chaotic week in Washington. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is out, and that news comes as a government shutdown is looming. The deadline is midnight tonight. The sticking point, the president's red line on border wall funding.
I've made my position very clear. Any measure that funds the government must include border security. Has to. Not for political purposes, but for our country, for the safety of our community.
The president is doing everything that he can to shut the government down. Have to ask the question, why?
I think it's a sad day in America when the Mexican government is doing more to protect our borders and stop the illegal flow of drugs, human trafficking, and terrorists across our border than Senate Democrats are willing to do.
President Trump is plunging the country into chaos. General Mattis is stepping down, and we know he has real disagreements with the president on Syria and on the wall. And now, President Trump is throwing a temper tantrum and creating the Trump shutdown of the government.
What is going on in Washington, and what does it mean for us here in New England? Let's dive right in with our week in review, and we're joined by our expert panel. John Carroll is WBUR's senior news analyst and the man behind Campaign Outsider, and it's good to live in a Two Daily Town blog. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks for coming in. Great to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start there with this looming shutdown. Federal funding expires tonight for the National Park Service, among a number of other agencies, at midnight. CNN has their always helpful and not at all stress-inducing countdown clock that's been going on all day. So you've got 75% of the government that has already approved their budget bills unaffected. The remaining 25%, though, does include some pretty significant high-profile agencies and departments: Homeland Security, the Justice Department, Transportation, Commerce, the Interior. What do you make of the looming shutdown?
First thing I have to say is I don't speak for the government, obviously. the thing I keep wondering is who the president thinks this is a good idea, because it shows you what an information bubble he's in, that he's getting this from, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and people like that. But, you know, in the meantime, he's annoying the daylights out of his own Senate, which is, you know, held by the Republicans, and he's certainly going to need their help in coming months. So, you know, making Mitch McConnell mad doesn't seem like a good idea. This really is just another one of those base strategies. But I really wonder how popular it actually is. And I think his attempt to kind of, you know, pass this off as a Democrat shutdown after he's been on television saying, I'll own it, it's mine, I want it, I'll be proud of it. I think the president's decision making has become a little bit scrambled over the past few weeks.
So we'll get to that back and forth in just a second. But John, your thought.
I mean, we've known for a long time that Donald Trump is America's first Cubist president. I mean, he's been on every side of every issue. And so it's no surprise that he's been on both sides of this one, both sides of all kinds of issues. You know, I don't think he cares about the Republican senators. I don't think they voted for him, frankly. I think he, you know, he has decided he's going to bunker down with his base. Now, the good news is that there are a couple of GoFundMe pages that have been launched that have raised about $2.5 million for the border wall.
I think that's actually up over 11 million.
Over
now,
11
point,
million.
Yeah.
We're getting up there. So start the thermometer, right? The bad news is Donald Trump could have had $25 billion for the wall back in February if he had made a deal with the Democrats around DACA. And so Mr. Art of the Deal is basically negotiating himself down, and now he's found himself in an untenable position.
So speaking of deals, it looked like we might avoid this shutdown until the president said yesterday basically that he will not sign a spending measure that doesn't include the money for the wall. The House last night passed their stopgap funding bill, which does include more than $5 billion for the wall. That's been the line that Trump has drawn. WBUR spoke with Congressman Joe Kennedy last night. Here's what he had to say.
I think this is outrageous. I think it's disappointing. I think it's sad. I think it's juvenile. I think it's a mistake. It never should have gotten to this. A compromise came out of the Senate unanimously. And somewhere along the way, the president decided to go back on that compromise with no plan and no strategy and no clue forward.
So as of this second, the Senate has not voted. Who knows when that'll change? Are we definitely looking at a shutdown at midnight tonight, do you think?
It looks that way. It certainly looks that way. I mean, he doesn't have 60 votes in the Senate to pass a border wall funding at a $5 billion number. So I think that this is an exercise that he's going through. And I think he's looked at this, Donald Trump has looked at this and said, you know what, maybe it's better to shut down the government now. When we come back January 3rd, there's a Democratic House, and the optics for him are better that he can't get something done, and if he has to back down, he's backing down from a split Congress, then he's backing down from a Congress that he should own.
Well, you mentioned 60 there, too, and Tom, I want to ask you, the president has encouraged a nuclear option override that go to a straight majority on this. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I don't know that Mitch McConnell, I'm not sure Mitch McConnell is taking, I should say I used to work in the U.S. Senate. I don't know that McConnell is going to be taking advice from the president on legislative strategy. And the other thing, one possibility here where we don't get a shutdown, the president also, you know, as John points out, he's on every side of every issue. He also has a track record of doubling down, putting a stake in the ground, and then folding, which could well happen this time because he may have already gotten what he wanted from the shutdown, which was to change the news cycle. We're now so far into so many stories in the news cycle that the shutdown almost seems like 6 weeks ago. But he may have just thrown this out there to say, wow, Rush Limbaugh's really mad at me. And if I do this, you know, I'm a hero to the base and it'll change the news stories.
So, Tom, you mentioned at the top that the president was on record on TV. Everybody saw and heard him say this would I'm proud to shut the government down over this issue. He tweeted today, the Democrats now own the shutdown. Is it possible that he can pass the blame off on this? Who pays the price politically if the government does shut down?
Yeah, I didn't crash the car. You crashed the car. You've got the keys. You're behind the steering wheel. I just don't think he's going to be able to make it stick. I mean, how do you pass off a shutdown as belonging to the Democrats when you have both chambers of Congress, both houses of Congress, and you're the president, and your own Senate has unanimously sent you a deal already? But I think that's just a standard Trumpian playbook thing to say, oh, something bad, when good things happen, I did that. When bad things happen, somebody else did that.
So you say that, but this is a president who has gone back and forth on a few different issues, DACA, healthcare, for example. And yet hasn't lost too much support from that base. So I do wonder, John, do you think why doesn't anything stick to him? And can he avoid the heat on this one?
So many things are baked in at this point. I mean, so many things on both sides are baked in at this point. And nothing is really changing anybody's mind. So he's decided the only way he gets to be reelected, the only way he gets to stay in power is to make sure that nobody defects from his base. And so he's got that mentality, and that's what he's going for. But he's also being jerked around because there are a whole lot of people who think the Syria move that he's making, pulling troops out of Syria, is a bad move. And, you know, Brian Kilmeade of Fox and Friends is giving Sarah Huckabee Sanders a hard time. And when you've lost Brian Kilmeade, you've lost, you know, I don't know who. You've lost Brian Kilmeade. But the truth of the matter is, you know, he's being whipsawed between these two factions and these policies and these sort of two major issues. And I think that he's just hoping for the status quo. And, you know, he can't stand being called gutless by Ann Coulter. And so even though he unfollowed her on Twitter, he basically did what she said.
So you mentioned Syria in that answer. That leads to kind of the other big news out of Washington this week. President Trump's decision to withdraw all the troops from Syria, about half the troops in Afghanistan, about 7,000 troops there. That led to Secretary of Defense James Mattis to announce his resignation. And he said in his letter to the president that that the president has, quote, the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours. Tom, your reaction to Jim Mattis stepping down?
Well, again, good time to point out that I don't speak for Secretary Mattis. We keep using words like unprecedented, but it is literally true that this is unprecedented. You've never had a Secretary of Defense resign in protest and issue that kind of, you know, by the standards of Washington culture and civility, that was a blistering letter. It doesn't have any ending, you know, salutation. There's no expression of gratitude for serving the administration. I wish you the best. All that's, it's like, you're wrong. These are bad things you're doing. You deserve to have somebody who's willing to execute your plans, whatever they are, and thank you for letting me serve the men and women of the armed forces. Goodbye. It alarmed. Personally, my reaction was I'm deeply alarmed by this. I mean, I really, you know, I slept better at night knowing that Jim Mattis is Secretary of Defense, and I'm concerned about it.
There was another voice who weighed in on the decision to withdraw troops from Syria. Vladimir Putin has actually praised the decision during his end-of-year news conference. Here he is through a CBS News interpreter this week.
I do generally agree with the President of the United States. Whether do we need the presence of the American military? I guess we do not need that presence. The presence of your troops is illegitimate, so if you've made this decision, it is the right decision.
So, Tom, you're a professor of national security affairs. What do you make of Putin's comment there and what it means for the U.S.?
Wow, shocker. Really stunning. I think the foreign intelligence services of the world have profiled the president pretty completely. I mean, the president provides a running commentary on his state of mind all day. And I think this is Putin being an intelligence officer. He's being very adept. He's reinforcing behavior he likes. He calls him Donald. He reaches out in a very personalized way. I mean, this is, you know, straight out of the book, manipulation 101. So none of this is surprising. That Putin likes it. And the decision itself, I mean, if we're going to talk about the merits of the decision, because I don't think the president made this decision based on the merits. I think this is, as John's been pointing out, you know, keeping his base. Although one thing I was going to note, John, is he's keeping his base, but he's not expanding it either.
Right.
I mean,
he's not going anywhere with this.
On the merits of it, it's a terrible thing to do. I mean, we can argue about whether or not it's a good idea to get out of Syria. It's a bad idea to get out of Syria this way. This is pretty much jumping out of an airplane without a parachute.
So, John, I just want to ask you, Senator Lindsey Graham, among other prominent Republicans, have come out and spoken pretty strongly against this policy shift. It's not the first time that Republicans have criticized him. Some are saying this is a tipping point. What do you think? Yeah. Is this actually the time when the Republican Party changes course?
There is no tipping point. Okay. Not with this Republican Congress. I just don't see it. I mean, the way Trump went about this is so antithetical to any kind of intelligent decision-making. He didn't consult with the military. He didn't consult with our allies in the coalition in Syria. The White House is trying to sell this as Putin being really upset that the U.S. is pulling out, when Putin is saying exactly the opposite thing. I mean, what he has done is essentially pull back the U.S. from a leadership role in the world, abdicated the role that we've had, and really undermined basic American values and principles that have been in place for 50 years. What he's doing is he's basically weakening our allies, he's strengthening our adversaries, and essentially undermining America's role in the world. And it's happening because there's no adult in the room at this point.
There was an interesting thing that happened with this, too, because one of the things that came out today is supposedly Erdogan got him to do this, right? The president of Turkey got on the phone with him and said, you know, you should pull out of Syria. And Trump says, okay, I'll do it. And apparently at that point, Erdogan was like, whoa, bro, you know, hold on. You know, you don't want to just do that right away. So even the guy that supposedly talked him into doing it, you know, kind of tried to pull him back off the ledge for a minute because the Turks aren't ready for a full American pullout, you know, leaving a vacuum behind them. So even Erdogan is on the phone with him saying, yeah, I want you to do this, but, you know, whoa. Take it easy.
Last through the looking glass moment, Trump on that phone call was supposed to say to Erdogan, don't go across the border and attack the Kurds who have been helping us and have been shedding blood on our behalf. He never said that. Instead, he says, you know what? We're going to leave. Do what you want. So, again, you know, this is completely through the looking glass and nobody can predict what's going to happen. And Trump likes that. Trump likes
except
the chaos.
They'll say the opposite of whatever they put in front of them.
Very possibly, yeah.
All right, so let's shift gears here and move to a more local story. Newberry College announced last Friday it would be closing its doors at the end of the academic year. It's now the second small liberal arts college in Massachusetts to announce it'll be closing this year, the other being Mount Ida. And it actually came out this week that Newberry College recruited students from Mount Ida before now announcing that they are going to be closing. So no big deal here. Just in a few minutes, I'd like you guys to solve all the problems facing the higher education system here in this country. Seriously, what do you make of Newberry College closing? And then we'll get to the recruiting of Mount Ida students.
After well, that. First of all, it's a shame that the college is closing because it's a distinctive college. It's been around for 56 years. It's got about 700 students. Two-thirds of them are low income. Over half of them are students of color. So this is a real loss to the community. Part of the problem is they have trouble competing. The small colleges have trouble competing with the large colleges. Part of the problem is they can be overextended. And part of the problem is financial mismanagement. And I think that all three of those come into play at Newberry. They're trying to paint themselves as sort of the opposite of Mount Ida. But they did a fair amount of misleading. It certainly appears from news reports when they were recruiting people, students from Mount Ida, and they were hiding their financial condition. And I think that's unfortunate, too.
Yeah, to that point, actually, we spoke with Barbara Marshall. Her daughter, Samantha, was one of those Mount Ida students that was recruited and transferred to Newberry. She's obviously very concerned about this situation and had even asked some of those questions ahead of time. So here's what Barbara, Samantha's mother, had to say when she spoke with us.
Admissions came to Mount Ida specifically to recruit students. My daughter asked a very specific question about their finances, and the person who responded by email said that they did some research into the subject and gave, you know, their financials and said that they specifically said that there were no mergers or closures in the near future.
So other than that, what can parents and students do to protect themselves?
I'm going to be Ebenezer Scrooge here for the Christmas season and say, and this is partly out of some research I did when I was writing The Death of Expertise about small colleges, that I think some of this, without taking the issue of Newberry specifically, but the small college problem in general in the United States is the idea that everybody should go to college. And as a result, you still have colleges that are being buoyed artificially by a lot of loans, by a lot of aggressive recruitment. And there's an argument to be made that, and again, I don't know if it pertains to Mount Ida or, you know, this situation, but there's an argument to be made that some of these small colleges, their time is just done. They're too expensive. The students who go to them aren't going to recover the cost, what it costs to go there. Now, I don't think, you know, I don't want to see a world where there are only big state universities and Ivy League campuses. But I think there was a proliferation after the baby boom in particular of students that kept these colleges open. And I don't think that's been a sustainable model for a good 20 or 30 years at this point. So I'm kind of not surprised to see some of the smaller colleges just having to kind of give up the ghost. And I think it's a trend that's going to continue.
Yeah, John, what do you think? Have we seen the peak of the small liberal arts college?
We may have. This was the death of the small liberal arts and small college in general was predicted when online learning started to become a big thing. I don't think that has actually come to pass to the degree that people thought it was. But there's going to be a shakeout, and the shakeout is going to be in the smaller brick-and-mortar colleges where essentially they can't compete with the larger colleges for amenities. There's a race for amenities at this point. The food, the board.
Rock walls, you know, rec facilities, yeah. Swimming pools.
Exactly. So if you can't keep up with that sort of arms race, you're going to be falling behind year after year after year, and it piles up. And what happens is what happened to Newbury.
All right, so before we get to our final week in review topic, I just want to point out some news that's just breaking this hour. The Supreme Court has rejected President Trump's request to restart an asylum ban. That ban would have barred immigrants who entered the United States illegally from seeking asylum. It was a close vote, 5-4, with Chief Justice Roberts joining the court's liberal wing for the majority. The court did not provide a reason for their decision, and we'll have more on this at 4 today on All Things Considered. So finally, before we run out of time, I want to touch in on the ongoing National Grid walkout. After failed contract negotiations, more than 1,000 workers have been off the job since June. Some of them attended a rare Friday House session on Beacon Hill, hoping for some movement on a bill that would extend their unemployment benefits, which run out in January, fast approaching. The Massachusetts Senate on Thursday passed a bill that would extend those benefits for those workers. Here's Governor Baker on Wednesday.
We want the lockout to end. We've made that clear to everybody. We've facilitated meetings and engaged in discussions with both sides. We brought them together. And I really do hope they both sides live up to their commitment to get this thing done by the end of this year, which is what they've been saying for a while they were going to do. And we've spent a lot of time this week talking to our colleagues in the legislature about what we all might be able to do collectively to ensure that if the lockout continues, that the workers associated with that will continue to have access to unemployment benefits.
So what do you guys make of Beacon Hill trying to extend the unemployment benefits for these workers?
Well, what you've got ships passing in the night at this point. The Senate has one bill. The House has another bill. They're going to have to reconcile them at some point, but they're taking very different approaches. So the Senate says basically any company that locks out its workers, you know, those workers are eligible for unemployment benefits and extended unemployment benefits, but it comes out of the state system. The House says basically if a utility locks out its workers, all utilities chip in and pay for the unemployment benefits. There's not even a program in place for that. It's not even clear that that's what the House wanted. At any rate, this either way, it's not going to put a whole lot of pressure on National Grid to get off the dime. So really this in a way will help the workers, but it won't really help the process very much because there's no further heightened sense of urgency for National Grid to solve this.
It's a really interesting point because on its face you think, great, these people who have been out of work since June, it's something to protect them and help them, especially through this holiday season and beyond. But as was pointed out in a Boston Globe editorial yesterday, it basically takes the financial stakes out of this. National Grid's not footing the bill, and now the workers have their benefits extended. Tom, what do you think?
Well, this is where I throw off my cloak and remind people I'm a conservative.
it's hard to recognize these days, right?
You know, yeah, well, you know, particular a Massachusetts conservative there back when there was such a thing. But, you know, that it gives me the willies to see the state intervening in a dispute between, you know, a company and a union. And it does. It's interesting. I mean, in this, I think I agree with both of you that what's really happening is, okay, the legislature has said, you know what, you can offload the cost of a strike onto, well, depending on who, to either the taxpayers in the Senate version or the utilities in the House version.
But, it's a lockout, not a strike.
A lockout, excuse me. Yeah, but, you know, that this dispute, you know, that's what I meant to say, that this dispute, you know, is basically now, as you pointed out, National Grid can say, all right, well, if you guys want to subsidize the cost of an ongoing dispute, fine. You know, what's that to us? And this is where I think government intervention, you know, kind of makes me uncomfortable because I don't see where this really does anything but give everybody a lot more time to be mad at each other.
Are there any big picture stakes here for organized labor in general?
There are always big picture stakes for organized labor. Organized labor is looking for any kind of win that it can get. It got one with Marriott to a certain degree. They're hoping to get one with this, at least in the court of public opinion, if nowhere else. National Grid supposedly was coming forward with a new contract offer today. They seem to be just as far apart as ever. So I think unions are not in a position of strength at this point, and I think that if they had a little more public opinion behind them, that would help, but I don't think that they've really generated that in this situation.
There's a live by the sword, die by the sword danger here, too, that if government intervention is going to be the thing you rely on, then, you know, that can turn against you down the line. But in this case, as John points out, it's a, you know, a win's a win, at least for the short term. Yeah.
All right. So we've got just enough time here. Let's wrap up this week with our hubbubs, the brief stories or events that caught your attention over the week. John, let's start with you.
Okay. So my hubbub is about Union T-shirt Day at the Boston Globe, which was Tuesday, and that was in response to a contract proposal that the Boston Globe has offered to its Boston Newspaper Guild union workers that basically eliminates overtime, seniority, pay scales, job descriptions, and severance pay. So this is – the Globe has brought in a law firm that is known as a real smash-mouth negotiator in terms of unions. And so this is a bad omen for the Globe workers. So they said, let everybody wear your union T-shirt on Tuesday, show some solidarity. The oddest thing is that this week John Henry told Dan Kennedy of Media Nation that the Globe is turning a profit. So the question is, if you're turning a profit, why the smash-mouth negotiations? The answer may be John Henry's going to sell the paper. Who knows?
Wow. Very timely considering our organized labor discussion a segment ago. Yep.
I'm trying to make my hubbub a tradition, which is, as a transplanted son of the Commonwealth who now lives in Rhode Island, my hubbub is an Ocean State hubbub.
All right.
There is a new book out, and it's the feel-good family Christmas reading. It's actually being advertised as a stocking stuffer. It's called Choices. You make them, you own them. And it's by a guy who worked for the mob in Providence as a professional leg breaker and did 29 years for murder. And he's now on a book tour. He co-wrote a book with a police captain from Rhode Island, and they literally had a thing on a website saying, "Hey, it's a stocking stuffer for Christmas." But there is a local connection because he's still feeling pretty raw about Whitey. He thinks Whitey got what he deserved because there are guys, as Jerry Tillinghast pointed out, he said there are guys probably sitting in prison because of things Whitey did with the FBI. So it shows that for this warm holiday season, there is still honor among thieves.
All right. So my hubbub is a little bit of a shout out. Last Saturday, my family, as is not quite an annual tradition, but we go as much as we can. We attended a performance of A Christmas Carol at the North Shore Music Theater. It's been running there since 1989. And two cast members, David Coffey, who plays Scrooge, and Cheryl McMahon, who plays Ms. Dilber, Scrooge's maid, and also Mrs. Fezziwig. It's their 25th year performing this show, and they have just such an incredible chemistry. The show runs through Sunday the 23rd. I just checked this morning. Tickets were still available. So if you're looking to get a little extra Christmas spirit, go ahead and check that out. So that's John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and the man behind the campaign Outsider and It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town blogs. John, thanks for coming in as always.
Thank you.
And Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks for coming back as well.
Thanks. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you both. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. Why would a comedian run for office? That's the question comedian Jimmy Tingle will be asking and answering next Friday and Saturday night in his new comedy show. And if you don't know Jimmy Tingle, here's an example of his trademark political satire.
We can all see the influence Christianity's had on Donald Trump. I think it was Jesus himself who once said, "Build a wall across the southern border. Keep out other people named Jesus."
The longtime comedian ran for lieutenant governor of Massachusetts earlier this year, and while he didn't win, he's ready for his second, or I guess maybe his third act. Here with me now in the studios, comedian, writer, actor, activist, and Boston comedy fixture Jimmy Tingle. Jimmy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Chris, great to see you. It's my fifth act, Chris.
Your fifth act. All right, all right. So I want to start with the obvious question, and yeah. It's one you've asked yourself. Why would a comedian run for office?
Right. Well, I've been, as you could hear from the clip, I've been doing social and political humor for years. I started about 1988 doing it, and I've just always been motivated. That's what kind of got me jazzed to perform. And after the 2016 election, I felt that, you know, I saw the success of Trump and I saw the simplicity in his messaging, three words. And I felt if Trump can use his background as an entertainer to communicate his message, that message, I can try to use my background as an entertainer and communicate it to communicate our message. And my message is, oh, I also had three words. He had three words. What was that? Build the wall. Lock her up, drain the swamp, and make America great. Three words, right? I had three words, too. Feed the hungry, house the homeless, heal the sick, welcome the stranger, and I would add, fix the tea.
That's a message I think that would resonate here.
John, I mean, Chris, if John F. Kennedy could inspire a generation to go to the moon, we ought to be able to get a train to go to Springfield. We get commuter rails to go to New Bedford and Fall River. And I think, Chris, if we put our heads together, we could get a train to connect North Station to South Station. We can do these things.
I can't believe that wasn't a winning message.
It was a winning message.
Fair enough. So was it a specific moment that you remember I decided, all right, that's it, I'm going to run? Or was it just kind of a gradual thing that you
I had gone back to school. I went to the Kennedy School of Government in 2010. I went back to school to see if I could use entertainment for purposes beyond entertainment. And after the election of Trump, I said, you know, I want to run, and I want to run on statewide level, and I think lieutenant governor is the right position. I asked Bonnie Frank. Anyway, before I asked Bonnie what he thought. He thought it was a great idea. He became our honorary chairperson, actually. But leading up to it, I was on the fence. Do I do it? Do I not do it? Do I do it? Do I not do it? And then I used to do a bit on the wind farm off the coast of Cape Cod. I was saying on stage, you know, if they've been arguing about this wind farm for 15 years. I said, this is America. There's lots of windy places. Do we have to put all the windmills off the coast of Cape Cod? Why can't we put some of the windmills in the breakdown lane on the Mass Pike? Look at all that untapped wind on the Mass Pike. Vroom, vroom, vroom. Now think about this, Chris. Using wind generated by cars, running on oil to turn little windmills to create electricity to reduce our dependency on oil, right? Obviously, it's satire, but it's rooted in advocating for the power of the wind.
Right.
Well, I'm on the fence. Do I do it? Do I not do it? I got an email from a woman in India in September of 2017. I'm not kidding you. She said, Mr. Tingle, I saw your comedy routine a few years ago at the Montreal Comedy Festival in Canada, and I just want to let you know that your vision for putting windmills on the highway to generate electricity is now being implemented in India.
Really?
Chris, I took it as a sign. Clearly, I have to run. I'm a visionary.
There you go.
But that was a turning point right there, because I felt, I mean, Albert Einstein said creativity is more important than knowledge. I felt I had the creativity to help.
Well, I'm curious, because you are kind of known as a comedian and funny guy around around Boston and the greater Boston area. Did you have a hard time getting people to see you as a serious candidate running a serious campaign?
Not the people who know me. Not the people who come to my shows, not my family, not people who had been coming for years, because as you could hear from the clip in there was always usually content behind the jokes. There was usually some sort of an advocacy position, and it was rooted in some sort of satire, some sort of truth. So the people who knew me, the people that didn't know me, because of the Trump election and because of the entertainment factor in his background, people were more, I wouldn't say dismissive, but they were more on the fence. They had to be convinced. But when I got in front of people and I met them at their house parties or town committee meetings or rallies around the state or at the convention, people were convinced that it was a serious campaign, and it was a serious campaign. And I was running because I believe very strongly the government matters, and the government can change people's lives, and at times government can actually save people's lives.
Okay, so from serious campaign, now you're back on the comedy bandwagon. Yeah. How does that feel? How's that been?
It feels great. It was a little bit of a transition getting back, finding my balance on stage. You know, I don't want to in any way trivialize the campaign or my efforts to become a lieutenant governor, but at the same time find the humor in it in a respectful way. And that's what we're doing in the show. The name of the show is Jimmy Tingle Stand Up. Why Would a Comedian Run for Office?
There you go. That's Friday and Saturday. And that is comedian, writer, actor, activist, and entrepreneur Jimmy Tingle. Jimmy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks a million for having me, and great to see you again, Chris.
For information about when and where you can see his comedy show, Why Would a Comedian Run for Office, go to radioboston.org. You'd be hard-pressed to make it through the holidays without hearing this. The Nutcracker is a 53-year holiday tradition for the Boston Ballet. And for one member of the company, this year's production is proving to be not only a career milestone, but also an important moment for diversity on stage. Kirsten Fintroy, who's playing the Snow Queen in several other roles for the Nutcracker, is currently the only black woman in the Boston Ballet and the first black woman to join the company in 10 years. Radio Boston's Paris Alston spoke with Fintroy after a rehearsal.
Practice was ending as I arrived at the Boston Ballet's rehearsal studio. Little ballerinas were walking excitedly around the lobby, and the older dancers were perfecting their spins and twirls in front of a mirror. For Kirsten Fentroy, that meant moving from one extraordinary and beautiful position to another, with what looked like effortless grace. She was clearly exhausted, but excited to perform in the Nutcracker because, as she told me, that's the first ballet most people see. And that's where her love of ballet began.
I think my first vivid memory of the Nutcracker is being one of the little girls that comes out from Mother Ginger's skirt. That was like my first like featured thing. I was like three, but I was the last girl to leave the stage and I got to do a cartwheel. And I was like, yes!
Fentroy is the daughter of two dancers and says she's happy that the ballet hasn't put too much emphasis on her identity.
I can tell that they didn't bring me into this company because they needed a black girl. They never made a big deal out of me being the first in 10 years, you know? And I appreciate that because it makes it feel normal. And that's what we want, is to be just one of the dancers.
She admits that there are challenges to being the only black woman in a company, from having to wear her hair in an afro in a ballet when others are wearing their hair down, to feeling insecure, haunted by the feeling that she's not good enough to be in certain roles.
You can get that feeling of, am I only getting cast in this role because I am their dancer of color? And if they don't put me in this role, they aren't featuring their dancers of color. So someone's going to say something. It's just something that I've kind of beat into my head, that it doesn't matter how much work I put in, it's never going to be enough in my mind.
Fentroy hopes that seeing her dance will help younger girls feel like they belong on the stage too, so that someday the presence of an African-American on the ballet stage isn't newsworthy.
We can't solve this problem of diversity in one day, but we have to plant the seed, and it has to start from these little kids that are in class and that go and they tell their friends, like, hey, I'm doing ballet class. And then their other friends of color can come and do ballet too, because they're like, oh, my friend is going to do this and I feel okay because she's there.
In the meantime, Fentroy is practicing and focused on the feeling that drew her to ballet in the first place when she was a little girl, as she moves from Mother Ginger's skirt to dance as the Snow Queen.
The snow scene is really, it's like one of my favorite scenes in the entire Nutcracker, with the snow falling. And it's, in my opinion, the best part of the score. The music is just beautiful. It feels like you're living in a snow globe.
That's Radio Boston's Paris Alston. And you've got one more chance to see Kirsten Fentroy dancing as the Snow Queen in the Nutcracker at the Boston Ballet tonight. The production runs through December 30th. Stay with us. Coming up, two cocktail ideas to help you make it through the holidays. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. As we're very much in the holiday season, we wanted to end this week with something a little sweeter.
You like sugar, huh?
Is there sugar in syrup?
Yes.
Then yes! We elves try to stick to the four main food groups. Candy, candy canes, candy corns, and syrup.
Yes, that's Buddy the Elf, of course. And in front of me right now, among some other things I'm told, is some maple syrup, which I'm pretty excited about. We're going to do something a little creative with our maple. It's going in one of two holiday cocktails we're going to make here in the studio. And both of those are brought to us today by Lonnie Newburn. Lonnie's the owner and operator of the Boston Shaker, the craft cocktail supply store in Somerville, Massachusetts. And we also have an eager audience joining me in the studio for him.
So eager.
That is Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell and Paris Alston. Welcome all three of you to the
Thank
show.
You, Chris.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Chris.
So Lonnie, let's jump right in. I'm really looking forward to this. Maple I love, and, I've heard there's also old fashioned involved. So let's hear what you got.
Totally. Yeah, we're going to roll on something sweet. We do have some maple syrup here. We got some great Vermont maple syrup from our friends at Cask Force. They're a local Boston company, but they're aging it in bourbon and rye barrels. So we're hoping that mixes up well with our nice dark rum and a rum old fashioned. We're using one bottle today to make two cocktails, keeping it simple for the holidays.
Beautiful.
Old fashioned Manhattan's still the holiday classics around the family table. People are mixing up their kind of strong drinks for after dinner. So for this one, we're going to feature a local rum. We got Medford Rum from Grand 10 in South Boston. And we're going to build this in a mixing glass. We got a couple of friends. We want to make at least three old fashions so we can all sip on them. So it's nicer to have a little larger vessel to stir them up in.
That's what I like to hear.
I love old fashions.
Go big or go home, right?
This cocktail comes from one of the new cocktail books. It's actually Nightcap by Kara Newman. She's a great New York cocktail writer. And her cocktail is called the Flapjack Old Fashioned. It uses 2 ounces of an aged rum. Again, we're going with the Medford. Mm. The maple syrup here is going to add that nice sweetness. We're only doing about 1/4 ounce per cocktail, so it's a pretty sweet one.
It smells so good.
Oh, yeah. Very fragrant.
I feel like I need to waft it.
It's going
to
make it super decadent.
Yeah.
So I'm a big old-fashioned fan. I feel like they're kind of having a moment. Are they having a resurgence?
Is you know, definitely during the holidays, the shaker's full of people making great cocktail gifts. But the one that comes up a lot is the old-fashioned. It's the iconic cocktail. Very simple. Spirit, bitters, and sugar. This time we're going to be rolling in something different for the sugar, the maple syrup. So easy to make and fun to do around the holidays. I got my ingredients in this big mixing glass. I'm going to add some bigger cubes here. They're going to take a little longer to melt. And they're going to allow me to stir this cocktail for about 20 seconds is what I'm looking for.
All right.
So I got a big mixing glass. I'm going to take my spoon, get to the edge and all the way down. And I'm just going to stir this at a nice even pace by twisting and kind of pulling to really melt that ice and chill down, mix and dilute our cocktail.
Really
the old-fashioned is one of the strongest out there. So a little water goes a long way. I'm going to stir this about 20 seconds. And then I'm going to use a strainer. I'm going to strain it in these old-fashioned glasses. We got some fun ones here, though. Pineapple cut glass from the shaker.
Can you use any glass for an old fashioned?
You can, you know. Some people like it on the rocks. Some people like it neat. It's really up to the user at that point. I'm going to take this big one out.
So you said you're using the Medford rum. What in particular about that rum?
It's an iconic one. Honestly, back when Boston was a huge rum producer, we were doing Blackstrap molasses style rums. This one's definitely from that original Blackstrap molasses. And then it's got a real funky kind of rich flavor. So it goes well in stirred and shaken cocktails. So we're going to be using that for the old fashioned here. Then we're using that for the shaken cocktail later on.
Beautiful.
To finish this one, a little orange peel or like a zest goes a long way. So I'm going to do a peel of orange, just taking the swath here, and just pinching that orange oil over the top. It's going to make this rich drink a little more decadent, add a nice little orange aroma. If you want, you can go ahead and do two.
So would you add a cherry to this one or no?
Certainly. You could do, if you prefer the cherry, like in your Manhattan, your old fashioned, the cherry garnish is also iconic. So here you are, guys, our first cocktail.
This
is the
icons,
Flapjack Old Fashioned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, give it a swell. Cheers.
Cheers. We're far away from each other.
So we're starting off rich.
There you go.
Normally, the Old Fashioned, you could save it for after dinner, around the fire, or Monopoly, or just after the nice strong drink. Yeah.
And you can taste that nice little touch of maple syrup.
Yeah, exactly. really kind of takes the edge off. And that orange zest, that does really make it pop.
Yeah, totally. It's added a little citrus brightness to a drink that normally wouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So we said Old Fashioned's kind of having a resurgence, but I feel like maple is also having a resurgence.
Yeah.
I've seen that
in a few
different
cocktails. We're
pretty
fortunate on the East Coast. Yeah. As a substitute during the holidays, it's so decadent. This one especially, having that nice kind of warm bourbon kind of caramel flavor. Really can add it to, you know, pancakes, but it goes great in cocktails as well.
Maybe so, pancakes with the cocktail.
Yeah. But Castport's, they're out of South Boston. They're doing a great job.
So we had you on in the summer, and you did some summer cocktails with us. I'm curious, what makes a great winter cocktail or a holiday cocktail in your eyes?
Bringing in those allspice flavors, you know, we use a lot of the maple. We're going to be using the Montenegro here for the next one. Nice caramel, kind of clove and cinnamon flavors. You know, like you're drinking the holidays, really.
And I was saying, I love, you didn't bring to these, I love cranberries in my holiday cocktails.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've been making cranberry margaritas. So.
Yeah, totally.
Really good.
I do. The glass gives it a nice classy feel, too.
Yeah, it's got a nice glass there.
Right? Yeah. That, exactly. Right out of Mad
Men. Split ones. Again, this one, let the ice talk to it while it simmers there. You know, it's a stronger one, but, you know, you have to make full glasses. This is one of the original strong cocktails, yeah.
So Zoe is the producer who did some research coming into this and actually found out that the Old Fashioned is the world's oldest cocktail.
That's correct.
And apparently, like, what else did I learn? I learned that it's the oldest cocktail, and, that Don Draper is part of the reason it's had this
research. Certainly, yeah, you can watch him kind of make a classic Old Fashioned. Back then, they used a little bit of soda water and kind of he does the Boston Chop, if I remember, which is a interesting stirring technique. Okay. But in the end, it boils down, spirit, your bitters. In this case, you would use like an Angostura bitters, which is like an allspice, and the sugar.
What is the Boston Chop?
Boston Chop is when you take a spoon in your mixing glass, and instead of stirring elegantly, you just kind of chop at it.
Oh,
so you're going for it.
So not
we've got
elegant.
Some original.
I didn't know that there was a name for the different.
This town
techniques.
Has a lot to be proud of. That is not one of the most.
That's not really something to be
Although
proud of.
Although for the next one, I'm going to be using the original Hawthorne, which is like a no prong. So this is invented in Boston, 1895. So we've got a lot of cool like inventions coming from our town. And the next one is actually a shaken cocktail that really features one of Boston's favorite drinks, which is a daiquiri.
All right.
And even though we're in the winter season and a daiquiri is kind of a light, bright, shaken drink, it still does perfect with winter when you pair it with things like cinnamon syrup. And in this case, we're going to add a little Montenegro.
I'm very interested in this one because you say daiquiri. I'm thinking tropics, laying on the beach.
Yeah, the daiquiri timeout is welcome. It's a simple cocktail to make. It is one of those shaken drinks, but it's simple ingredients. We've actually taken a recipe from Drinking Like Ladies. This is a great cocktail book from two local authors. You got Kirsten Amon and Misty Kalfakin, both awesome bartenders in Boston. And this drink is actually comes from a bartender, the principal bartender drink, Ezra Starr. So this is one of her cocktails coming from Drinking Like Ladies.
Right?
Yeah, Drinking 4 Point, one of the best cocktail bars, you know, in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed both the books that you've brought, you got your recipes out of, they come from women. Is that something
that's correct.
You're trying
Kara
to do?
Newman out of New York.
Yeah.
And both Misty and Kirsten are great authors. We've got kind of featuring a lot of the famous women behind in history and also behind some of the best drinks out there. So,
great.
Yeah, we're drinking like ladies.
Cheers to the women writers.
I'll drink to that.
Enjoy your cocktails. I'm going to get started on the next one. This is a shaken cocktail. So this one has citrus. Anytime you have citrus in a drink, you do want to wake it up, shake it up. We're going to feature the same rum, the Medford rum. This is a nice, again, aged rum. So it goes in white American oak barrels. We'll get to it. More of a caramel flavor, which when you're making a shaken drink, using aged spirits is great to get that kind of like allspice, kind of darker feel. So this one's pretty simple. This is 1.5 ounces of rum. And I'm just going to pour this right into our Boston shaker. I'm going to double this up for you guys.
Whoa.
Yeah, you'll be all right.
So what makes that a Boston shaker, just that we're in Boston?
Yeah, originally a Boston shaker was a glass on tin. I'm using like the tin on tin here. But these were kind of a Boston invention. Originally the tins were manufactured here in Boston. So when they went abroad, even to Europe, they would say Boston on the bottom. So we actually got the name from across the pond. But yeah, this is what we get our name at the Boston Shaker. It's the iconic tool. It's the only one you need to really shake and stir at home.
All right.
So we got our rum in there. This one's going to be lemon juice instead of lime.
Again, is it fresh squeezed lemon juice?
It is. I have it right here.
Nothing but the
one
best,
of the rules of we have a takeaway in our classes is always use fresh ingredients, especially when it comes to citrus. It makes your cocktail brighter, and it's going to be much more enjoyable than like buying that kind of concentrate.
And you guys are really big on local too, right?
That's right, yeah. I actually got the cinnamon syrup from a local restaurant, Spoke Wine Bar. They're down there in Davis Square. They really helped us out. This is a nice allspice cinnamon syrup. So it's going to make this cocktail have that nice kind of baking spice as well. So we got our rum, our lemon juice, our simple syrup. And to make this one a little darker, and again, we're following the recipe, Montenegro is an excellent Amaro. It's kind of like a bitter. This has a nice orange and kind of caramel flavor. So we're just doing equal parts of the sugar, the Montenegro, and the lemon juice with 1.5 ounces of rum.
So is this a when would you drink this? Is it after drink?
Honestly, we kind of did reverse.
Whenever?
I would do this before.
It's
like an aperitif. You know, it's bright. It's light. It's got a little cinnamon, but it's going to get your palate ready for dinner.
Also, I want to throw up before you do this that you can watch Lonnie give this a little shake on Facebook Live as well.
That's right.
Radio Boston.
That's right. Yeah. So we watch people through shaking and stirring all the time at the shop. I'm taking the Boston Shaker.
It's coming up, so do it
now. I'm giving a flat edge to it, so I'm not lining up straight. And I'm giving a nice love tap. That'll make an initial seal, but when these tins get cold, it'll create a vacuum. It'll really hold this together, so you don't have to hold it too tight. My dominant hand on top, left hand on bottom. I'm just shaking up to my shoulder and down, kind of creating this motion. If I want to go faster, I just shorten my stroke, and now I'm in business. I'm shaking for about 10 seconds. You can count in your head, or you can feel it coming through the tins.
Okay,
you want to get this cocktail nice and cold.
So why does it matter how you shake it? You can wait till you're done.
Oh, you're in control of the dilution. You know, you want to shake it, wake it up to blend everything, really froth it up, aerate it because there's citrus, and in the end, get it down to that right balance with water. Most cocktails are about 20, 30% water. So at home, focus on shaking for 10 and stirring for 20 seconds, and you'll get a nice, cold, balanced drink. Don't short your shake there. So this one, we're going to serve it up. A daiquiri is usually served up in like a coupe-style glass. So we got some nice coupes here. These are the Leopold ones we carry at the shop. They're nice little tasting coupes, so they're not huge. So it's kind of a nice hosting cup if you're just having a lot of people come in. You can make two drinks and split it between multiple people.
There you go.
So here we go.
Thank you.
This is going to be our holiday daiquiri. Again, this is coming from Ezra Starr.
So what would you call this?
Well, actually, I should say it has a proper name. This is Elements of the Star, coming from Ezra Starr at Drink in 4 Point.
Cheers,
guys.
Mm-hmm.
So this should have some darker
notes.
Right.
Yeah,
you like that?
Oh, I love it.
Do you guys get notes of cinnamon?
That's
exactly.
This is great. So, Lonnie, I'm from North Carolina, it's a little warmer than
now,
and
just
this drink feels warm.
Yeah.
So, thank you. It's been warm in the right way, not in like that like Christmas. It's cold
Christmas
outside,
in July.
Warm inside, warm.
It's good
like
any time, you know. Again, we kind of winterized this one from this recipe, but a daiquiri is a great, easy-to-make cocktail anytime, whether it's tropical, warm, or just trying to stay warm during the holiday.
So what's your favorite holiday cocktail?
Honestly, we reach for the old fashions. I'm certainly going to be using some of this maple syrup at home. I do like a Negroni, and we had thought about doing another Negroni cocktail that's equal parts gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. but you can really add a lot of changes in flavor by just adding some bitters and, again, like an orange twist over the top of that. So a nice Negroni is also like a great holiday cocktail.
And Lonnie, if someone, like, I don't know, someone out there listening to me on the radio wanted to buy me a gift.
Yes.
For making one of these cocktails.
Whoever you may be.
Yeah, just hypothetically. We certainly have everything you need to find at the Boston minute. Shaker, your friendly neighborhood cocktail supply shop. We're right in Davis Square. We are on the web, thebostonshaker.com.
But what are they going to get me?
Oh, you know what? For you, I would think like an old-fashioned syrup, some maple syrup here. You can mix that with a cool ice tray so you got those large cubes. And maybe a spoon to stir it up.
Wow, you know me. You know me so well. Yeah.
I'm curious, though, because I love to do that. Walk into a cocktail specialty place and say, surprise me.
Oh, totally.
What do you kind of think about when you're trying to figure out?
Well, we ask questions about, like, you know, what they enjoy spirit-wise or what their experience with cocktails. We have things from everything from beginner to, you know, we work with a lot of the professionals in the city. So just their experience and background, and we kind of lead them to the right solution.
Is there a trendy drink in Boston right now or this time of year?
Yeah, this time of year, again, we're a daiquiri town, so that's good any time of year. I would say if you look around some of the great craft cocktail menus, they're doing a lot of things with shrubs, some really interesting house-made ingredients. So any bar you walk into, see what they're working with.
All right. Exactly. Well, that's Lonnie. He's the owner and operator of the Boston Shaker, the craft cocktail supply store in Somerville, Massachusetts. For recipes and more information about the cocktail and the books that Lonnie mentioned, you can visit our website, radioboston.org. Lonnie, thanks so much for coming in. Really
thank
appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
It.
Happy holidays.
And also thank you to Radio Boston producers Zoe Mitchell and Paris Alston. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.